This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about inclusivity as a factor in mental health. A theme that I'm sure at this point, I don't need to emphasize how important this is to what we care about and what we work towards here at Mental. And I'm delighted to be having this conversation with Martin Henson, who, among other things, is a community organizer, activist, speaker, and the creator of Be Men, which is an organization that aims to bring Black men together to talk about and work through issues that aren't often discussed openly. For example, mental health, healthy masculinity, identity, sexuality, homophobia, and sexual assault. And in more recent years, Be Men has also partnered with the Transgender Emergency Fund. Through opening these dialogues, each individual can walk away with a deeper understanding of the issues preventing open coexistence between these groups of people, but also a new awareness of the similarities in the types of discrimination that can be faced, and just the general day-to-day experiences that can affect all parts of your life, including, of course, mental health. So the range of Martin's work is something we very much talk about in the episode, where I'm always open to a conversation about how discrimination can impact people's mental health, but particularly through the chat we have today, it was lovely to highlight so many of the ways in which inclusivity can build connection and understanding, unity, and break down stigma, even around very difficult, sensitive topics, and how actually oftentimes these do very much need to be explored in tandem. That we talk about plenty on the show how intersectionality is a big part of excellent mental health treatment, that if people are experiencing negative circumstances in one area of their life, i.e. relating to their mental health, that support then can't exclude other areas. It has to have a person-centric approach, I guess I would call it. And as someone that goes to a person-centered counsellor, I know firsthand how validating and healing it can be to get to talk through elements of things that affect my mental health that can be situational, that can be to do with identity, that can be to do with bigger societal factors, and all of this stuff can get meshed together and feel really fuzzy and confusing at times. So it's always lovely to chat to someone like Martin, who has a background as a mental health counsellor and is so articulate at talking about all the ways in which inclusivity can bring us closer together, help with our mental health, and yeah, just create greater unity at a time when we need it. We're still going through a difficult time in the world. There is a lot on the horizon still, and I really appreciate having this kind of depth of conversation. Also, I related a lot to a lot of Martin's work in terms of campaigning. In particular, he has worked extensively with the Boston chapter of Black Lives Matter, and so shares a little bit about that and his work with restorative justice as a coach working with institutions in and around the Boston area. So, all of that to say this, loads of meat in today's conversation, and something to talk about that always feels so timely in my experience, in Danielle's experiences. So I think that's everything I have to say about today's theme, and I really hope you get as much from this conversation as I certainly did. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
We'll be right back.
My name is Martin Henson. My early experience with mental health was probably my own. Specifically thinking about it, I don't know if I had the language. My dad was killed when I was around 12. So dealing with the post-traumatic stress of that trauma was an experience. And how I was able to navigate through that, connecting me with community. I think there's a level of disconnection that you have with yourself when you lose something that valuable, someone so important to you. But at the time, mental health wasn't what I called it. There was no name for it. There was just trying to understand the world that had just been turned upside down. And over time, I grew to have a stronger relationship to eventually moving into counseling. But that was mm-hmm. the beginning.
And so at that time, what can you remember of how much of that experience you kind of could process at the time?
I couldn't really. The way that I rationalized where my mind was going to cope is that if that happened to him, maybe it was somebody close to him. So I have to guard myself to keep that from happening to me. And there was no post-traumatic language to that or grief-related episode. There's none of the DSM terminology for me to associate with. It was just, this is how I have to think about the world. As time goes on, you're able to blossom and become more than just someone waiting for bad things to happen and preparing for the inevitability of something like that. But at the time, that was the language I had.
Yeah. And how much were you aware of the circumstances around his death?
Not very aware. You know, it was never resolved. There was never, you know, arrest made or the case was closed. So there was a sort of making peace with not only my trauma, but the circumstances of my life that are fundamentally different now. That took years. It took a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. And so as you then got older and you're living life without this role model, how did you find that influenced you growing up and how you connected with other people?
Well, there's a few different ways to think about it. One way is that became the seeds of the work that I do now with BMEN Foundation, seeking out Black men and creating support systems and spaces, because that's what I got in that moment. My stepdad never left, was always around, even past his relationship with my mom, and all of my family, and specifically the male members of my family, stepped in and made me feel seen. Mentors and people from church, all different types of community, gave me a feeling of being held in this moment of chaos for me. And the other side of that is that the internal conflict that I was having, you know, I don't think you ever, when somebody's taken from you, I don't think you ever become what you were before. You adapt to that reality in a different way. But that's kind of, that was the process.
Yeah, no, I get that. And it's good to hear that so many people did rally around and you weren't lacking for those role models. But like you say, you know, how do you wrap your head around it? How do you not have that be an influence in your life? And I know certainly that's a conversation that can go on within counseling communities, that so often people that go into that line of work, they can trace back certain things that have happened in their life that brought them so close to, I guess you could describe it as like why humanity and why connection is so important. And so often it's when you've not had those things, when you've, you know, you've lost or you've experienced certain traumas that have made you feel disconnected. It reminds you the importance of how much we have to look after each other.
I wanted to do that as much as I could, and eventually led me into activism. When I was in school, I wanted to do philosophy, but I didn't want to be a teacher. So psychology was the next step. So my relationship to navigating through my own trauma and the care and support I received from my mother and many other people in my world, I just thought that I just naturally was kind of like that. Oh, it just kind of makes sense. But the kind of therapeutic tools that you have and need, some of that I had to develop from the world that where I was stripped from, you know, my father. So it wasn't that clear of a process for me.
Yeah, no, I definitely find that a lot of my life only really makes sense in reverse, that we can draw mm-hmm. these kind of lines. what sort of skills that you're talking about there can you see that you were building, even though, you know, at the time it might have felt like survival or just getting through?
Being neutral, being like therapeutically flat. As you're doing therapy, you have to, can't really react in ways that take energy and focus away from the person that you're working with. So that for me was a coping skill, and at times very unhealthy, because like I would suppress strong feelings so much because I just didn't want to be read literally by other people. And over time, that perceptiveness, that hypervigilance that you walk around with became something that I used empathically. I cared about people deeply, and I, you know, can notice things that are going on with you and how you think and how you feel, what you value. So there are some parts of me that would do that because I wanted to feel safe. I need to know who I'm dealing with. And I learned to be calm and pleasant. And then I'm like, oh, okay, you can use this in this other setting in a way that actually can support people. Now, have I ever put those things in those words before? No. But looking back on it, that's how I repackaged it in a few ways.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm sure going through that process of training to be a counselor, so much of that is to do with self-reflection, is understanding the point you're coming from in order to make sure you're not going to react unconsciously to certain things that come up with a client and thus, you know, kind of bias that sort of neutrality you're describing. So what sort of things did you find out about yourself and what you'd been through in terms of like understanding trauma better?
Well, I mean, it was kind of a rude awakening in a lot of ways. You kind of just, you catch yourself doing patterns and you actually get a therapist and you work through that. Going back a little bit to the type of settings that I'll be in and being around people who were interested in psychology and counseling as I'm going through school and some work environments, I honestly thought everybody was weird. I was like, man, these people are strange. Like, what is going on with them? And it was really more of a like a logical step to kind of evaluate myself deeper. I was like, oh, if I'm here and I think everybody here is strange, I must be like that too. I must have these things that I've had to work through that make me well suited for the job. So that kind of led me into a different place of being introspective and looking back. That must have been my early to mid 20s, like thinking about things in reverse, like you said. And I came up with some of the conclusions about who I am and what made me good for it.
Mm-hmm. In exploring who you were, how much of a factor was being a Black man in America?
Oh, it was always a factor. I tell the story often. My stepdad had me do book reports on Black people. Hated it at the time, but it was such a strong foundation. And then you would go to church and you have, you know, Black History Month in the Black church, and same thing as another church. It's just like, this is our time. And I would know so much and I would be so interested in and have so much pride and less fear in situations because I kind of understood things a little bit better. So I could understand the world from the position that Black men had to be in. And from looking back and, oh, these things have happened historically, and here are some of the dynamics that I'm experiencing. But it was a little bit, it's almost more objective in some ways, and it became more personal the deeper I looked into the things I had to grapple with. So one of those things is the expectation of a short life. I didn't realize until I was in my late 20s that I didn't expect to live long. And it framed how I planned for the future, because I'm seeing images of Black death. I've been confronted with the death of my father and some friends, and I've absorbed that into the way that I felt and seen and engaged in the world, but didn't know it until I actually started having to dig a little bit deeper to see, well, who am I and what makes the decisions that I've come to, and some of the conflicts that seem normal to me are things that all of these other people are experiencing.
Yeah. But all the same, whilst there can be shared experiences in that, grappling with your mortality in that way at such a young age is still a horrible thing to, you know, to have to contend with. It's still so intense.
It is. And you see, I mention this a lot when we talk about mental health. and the impact of trauma, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and some of the markers for it, as outlined by the DSM, is, you know, having an event happen to you, witnessing an event, learning that it happened to somebody else that you knew and you valued. So this kind of vicarious trauma can exist alongside the things that happen in your own world. So what's the impact of Black men, say, coming out of this more recent movement around Black life or Black Lives Matter movement or whatever the name or framing for it is, starting with the death of Trayvon Martin, that I have to see and absorb that death over and over again? I have to see video. I have to hear audio descriptions and have to read the transcribed accounts of what happened and read the articles and the see it on CNN. I see this death playing out to somebody that looks like me over and over again, years and years on end, at least once a day. So what is the impact on being, not only having this take on my own mortality, but having to witness it and having to absorb it because it's part of America's entertainment system in a lot of ways. Not unlike lynchings that would happen in the early 1900s where people would bring picnic baskets and it would be a community event. That's all of that, and then my own stuff. I don't know how to name or describe that to someone who hasn't been through that. So that I think, again, the work that I did with B-Men was like, I know y'all have probably been through something very similar and have some differences. Let's coalesce around each other and offer each other support in this overwhelming system of trauma that we have to wade through.
Yeah, overwhelming is so right, because we live in such a distinct age where there remains this kind of casualness around such triggering events. And, you know, you go on your social media and you're seeing just such horrible imagery that, you know, can connect so much to your own personal trauma and that of people that look like you. And it's right there in your phone next to like pictures of your friends and family. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that clear link in your mind, and then you're seeing it right there. And, you know, where do you go? You know, what social media were we not seeing images of George Floyd? You know, and I think there's also, you know, there's these additional pressures, not just in terms of what it brings up to you, but then, you know, talking to a lot of friends of mine who are people of color during, you know, the last few years, and generally, there's also this guilt that can come around it of, well, I need to be up to date. I need to know all the names. I need to know all the stories. I need to follow the trials and, you know, what police officers are held to account and what aren't, because of this kind of expectation that you'll know and that you should know, and that is part of some attempt to feel safe. And then I think that can also then be exacerbated by when certain things come up in the news, so many people around you will be turning to you and saying, oh, I have questions about this, or how are you feeling? And there's then this additional spotlight on you during an already difficult time.
Yeah, that's, you said something that triggered me, not in a way that I can't be present in the conversation, but it's important. So I was doing a lot of the activism work on the ground and going and having conversations with people around the Black death that was becoming so unavoidable in our public consciousness, not unprecedented, but just present in our way that we're thinking. In the names, having to know the names, I always felt like I was constantly eulogizing men and women that I've never met and wondering if I was doing right by them. And if they were here, would they feel properly respected and treated well? So that duty to the men that whose lives were lost was something that I always felt really strongly about. And I don't know, you said guilt, that's one way of framing it. The idea or the experience, sitting in that all the time and not having it ever be acknowledged. You know, you're sitting in this, and you know, America, you know, over here will say, well, you know, we'll have these like really neutralizing terms and language, like, oh, racial violence, racial justice, but like Black people are being oppressed, and you have to go and you unpack that, and you'll give the names and give the situations, and you all of the intellectual energy that you have to devote to saying things that people can bear witness to in a way that made them feel impressed, in a way that made them feel like you were articulate, that you were presenting the issue well, with the weight of the lives that are lost and the pressure of doing it good for our future. You know, the people that come after me, they're going to see and hear some of these things that I've said. I want to be a good example. We look at trauma as this time encapsulated thing. It happens in a moment, you're reacting to it in other moments, but it has been constant in the way that I've had to orient it, or in times I've chosen to orient as a way to try to control the things that feel uncontrollable. But it's like constant. You don't have the option to look or turn away. So I've started to name, there's these moments that when I was being kind of bombarded with this, as were many Black men, where I would just go to another place and I wouldn't realize that I've glazed over, or that I'm like flat, or that my language has changed. And I'll come back after that clip is done. And it wasn't probably until this year, actually, 34 now, that I was like, oh, this thing triggers me. I don't have to watch it. I don't have to engage with it. I can say no. But nobody's going to do that for you. That's the reality of being a Black man. Nobody's going to say, oh, let me protect you from this trauma. But because you're a man, you're expected to navigate through it. So we're caught in this double bind of advocating against our own death and having to bear witness to our own emotionality in ways that other people can't experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And even what you described there of that experience of disconnecting, of becoming sort of situationally numb to these experiences, can itself be a part of the PTSD. It's a way in which our minds kind of shield us from the trauma being built on.
Yeah, yeah. And that, always hard to have conversations around men being victims and men having to adapt to harmful situations, whether this is kind of without specific regard to race, but men in general, because we're expected to be a certain way, expected to be leaders, expected to protect. So I think it can put people in conflicting positions to say, oh, this is actually hard for me, while also acknowledging that I have to still be this thing for other people. And so that these moments are the ones that I think of where, you know, if I'm out with my daughter, I can't stop being her dad because I'm triggered right now. You know, I just kind of have to do what I have to do to kind of get through that moment, make her feel okay, and resume my day. But I've really taken special care and effort to make sure that, like, I'm not forgetting about, you know, who I am and my own emotional need in that experience.
Yeah. No, I think that's so important because, like you say, we can be raised with such narrow ideas of who people are, you know, that can be so surface value. And within that, it can be so ingrained that then we question who we are. You know, if masculinity is so tied up with being tough, then what about the days where you don't feel tough, where you don't feel strong?
Exactly.
Is your whole identity then compromised because you're having understandable human emotions? Of course not, but it can feel that way. And there is a lot of language that still exists around, you know, man up and boys don't cry, that perpetuates that, you know, and I don't doubt that young people still hear that. Hopefully not as much as when we were coming up, but it's, you know, it's still out there. And I think in circling to our theme of inclusion and inclusivity, it can be so difficult, strangely, for a lot of people to wrap their head around this idea of, like, who can be a victim of certain things. And sometimes there can be this pressure to justify. Like you said, you have to be perfectly articulate, or somebody has to be completely and obviously some kind of perfect victim, right? There's no ambiguity, there's no vagueness, there's nothing up for question. And only then will some people confront bigger societal problems, because there can be privilege in being separated enough from an issue that you can feel you're able to disconnect from it in a way that, through your experiences, you've described how that is not the case for everyone when you're closer in.
Right. And, you know, you made a point about inclusivity. I think I've taken a, you know, really winding journey around what that means. And if you're evaluating things from these points, like you mentioned, where this person is always the perpetrator, this person is always the victim. And also oftentimes going into more legalistic framings of criminal and offender and things like that. Like, how do you get outside of that? And so it's been a path to not try to define for other people what inclusivity should mean to them. And that we like big ideas. We like to throw them over the top of everyone and say, hey, this, here's the solution. Like, we can all do this. But inclusivity is an effort in engaging and creating community, listening deeply, having conversation around how things impact folks in ways that maybe you didn't assume. You don't really have to, because if you have those relationships, you don't have to depend on the systems to create logics for how you're going to treat people. So it's been a more intentional effort moving from reading books on things that I've seen, let's say if it's trans or queer issues, actually having conversations with my friends who are both trans and queer, not in ways that objectify them, but in ways that actually just talk about their experience. Maybe they name it as these terms, maybe they don't, you know, but I'm never going to know if I'm not in community and I'm not thinking about how other people are impacted by the things that I do. So from my position, some of the things I'm doing in Be Men, having the support group spaces where we're explicitly inclusive to straight, queer, trans, black men, I was always like adamant. I was like, I want to make sure that the norm is that everybody can come here, you know, and we're learning to make space and understand each other better. And nobody has to hide. You know, there's already enough pressures in this world. Like, if I feel free, I feel like you should feel as free as I do, and we can have a more full community together. Or doing the Bridging the Gap program, Black Straight Men, Trans Women of Color. So I was just tired of hearing narratives around Black men's relationship to trans women. Like, let me actually just figure this out for myself. Matter of fact, we can do that with other people too. We can make it an initiative to continue to have these conversations around two groups in the community that are perceived to be so distant. Let's actually talk about what are our experiences, what are the stigmas we wrestle with, what are the things that we have to overcome. So those are ways I've ingrained my wonderings about inclusivity and turned them into more tangible things that can be done to just be human and allow other people to do the same.
No, I love that. And, you know, having a show like this and working against stigma as so much of the core of what we do, we see the impact of that I'm sure you do, that we can have these kind of theoretical discussions, but it's something else to see it in practice, see people talk about topics that they thought they were never allowed to. And, you know, people don't run out the room screaming, you know, people don't shout them down, people listen and then share similar experiences. And even hosting this show years now, I'm still surprised by certain guests I talk to where I connect a lot with their experiences. And maybe I'd assumed we wouldn't. I'd assumed naively perhaps that you've got a diagnosis that I don't. We've had different diagnoses and maybe there won't be as much crossover. And actually, as we say around the show all the time, there's far more that unites us than divides us. And it's great to hear that you went into that mentality with these groups. You were like, okay, we want to get men talking about certain topics, but we don't want to start off by excluding anyone. Because then we're kind of like bringing one group up while sort of leaving another one to the side. And hearing you share a lot of your background, I can see how much that influenced the kind of work that you went into. So do you mind sharing a little bit about the types of conversations that happen and the types of initiatives you're involved in within Be Men?
You know, the interesting thing about Be Men, just to give a, you know, just quick overview, organization supporting Black men around issues specific to Black men. This is the simplest, easiest answer I can give. But having a conversation around what the needs of Black men were and what things they were experiencing continues to evolve. And you're continuing to refine the ways that you do it. So when I first started it, it was more so in the response to or influenced by Me Too. And I was like, oh, men aren't talking about this. And I went through a variety of thoughts around how to navigate. And I realized Black men actually aren't talking about this. And even casual conversations oftentimes reveal a Me Too story. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, maybe Black men need a space. So the B Men monthly meeting came from that. Just us coming together wasn't an initial initiative that I had in mind. Like, just, this seems to make sense. And then over time, the focus changed to actually focusing on the humanity of Black men. And there's framings within B Men that allows us to do all of it. But I was like, oh, if I'm not actually beginning with men's understanding of themselves, which I'm actually learning is interesting and not always the most protective to their own mental health, then it's going to be hard to actually get anywhere. So having these conversations, we've had so many good conversations. I've been referencing conversations I had with, we had a group one time, it was all Black men, of course, and it was like a couple of men were queer, and they were talking about how their long-term relationship goals and expectations or expectations people have of them are very different because they're not expected to have a family and have children, whether regardless of whether or not they want to or not. It's just not an expectation. As a Black straight man, I've never thought of that. And I'm like, oh. So it made me think about ways I could really be present to the Black men in our community, even the ones that are also queer who have a different path. I'm not just kind of assuming that everyone is kind of looking to move in the same ways. Having a conversation with Black men and trans women of color, talking about where did the first ideas and thoughts that you had of trans women come from. And we're processing it and thinking it, and I'm realizing, oh, first time I remember seeing trans women was on Jerry Springer, Ricky Lake, when they would bring all these people out and say, guess which one is a woman or a man? That was my first experience, you know? But if you don't have these dialogues, and more recently, we had a conversation in the B-Men group talking about boundaries. Like, what are your boundaries? How do you relate to them? We're giving each other advice and sharing our experience in the vulnerable moments where we've had to dig deep to understand what that meant. It's powerful. It's powerful when you acknowledge stigma and you say, hey, we're going to push through this or move this to the side and actually get to some of those things, because people can hold those things on their heart for so long. And that contributes to isolation, which there's all of these different markers that isolation, whether it be mental health, whether it be domestic violence, whether it be all types of other things that you can endure, isolation is such a negative factor in the overarching view of somebody's life. They're isolated. They're just going to have so many more difficulties. So all of these things kind of come together and really play out and be men in a variety of ways. I hope I answered your question. I feel like I was rambling.
No, absolutely. I'm just enjoying hearing about it. It sounds so positive and, you know, fascinating to have those conversations, and even you as a facilitator to that environment to still be like so surprised and find so much learning in a lot of the experiences you hear. And I think in particular, what I love is that you've identified that isolation piece, that in dealing with stigma, even, you know, communities within communities can become isolated from their own people. So if we've got the layers of, you know, what men think they can and can't talk about, and then what Black men think they can and can't talk about, what the world expects of you as a Black man, particularly, you know, with America's history there, it can create a very smothering experience to be like, okay, I don't know what I can be. You know, I only know what I can't sometimes. And within that, you can become really isolated, where then it's, you know, people in your family you don't know if you can talk to. And, you know, what you're describing there with like Black men and trans women of color, you know, they're two groups where I, you know, you seem to have identified that parallel around the isolation piece. And okay, here's two groups that both actually have more similar needs in terms of battling stigma and discrimination and misconceptions than they may even realize themselves. And how can we open up those conversations? And, you know, if you can talk to somebody who, you might have not thought you'd understand their perspective, and their perspective would be so different to yours. Well, then surely anyone, you know, in your community, in your hometown, might be someone you can relate to better than you thought.
Right, right. Exactly. And people are able to come into those conversations and go places that they didn't think that they would go. And you get rid of the idea, like, what's the worst that can happen? Or in those situations, if you have the stigma of people saying, like, oh, well, maybe this person is gay, or maybe they, it's a whole bunch of nonsense that people have to struggle with and tackle. And then you can kind of extend it further out to other types of stigmas that people may be dealing with and isolation related to it. Maybe they're dealing with sickness. Maybe they're dealing with being formerly incarcerated, or having a loved one that's incarcerated, or domestic violence, or just general everyday stress and trauma from maybe work or COVID. I think that people have to learn spaces where that can nurture them and tend to them. And, you know, I want to be a part of that learning through Be Men Foundation and create as many paths as possible.
And as we start to wrap up, I want to ask you about where you're at now, because you may not describe yourself in this way, but it's clear to me you're a role model to so many people. And so, having gone through a lot of difficult learning about yourself, gone through the process of becoming a counsellor, setting up this organisation, partnering with the Trans Emergency Fund, where has that brought you in terms of your mental health now, and how you think you're able to relate to the world?
Well, my mental health is a lot better than it used to be. I used to always feel like putting the world on my back is the best approach. And I've realized that you can really get far on your own, but you can get farther with other people. COVID really pushed me to think differently around the relationships I had and how I want to be present for people and how I want them to be present for me. So if I don't have a healthy frame of reference, then I can't do a lot. And the example that I'm setting is not the best one. I'm grateful that I'm always learning and growing and understanding myself better. I think I'm always going to be blooming as a flower if I'm doing this life thing correctly. So there's no end point for it. And I think I've learned to accept that and travel the path as best I can. And with that, I have a far more healthy outlook on my mental health than I've had in the past.
It's good to hear. And the second part of my question there was around your experiences of connecting with other people, now that you're such a champion for people reaching out and breaking through stigma and having difficult conversations. How have you noticed what that's like for you to go out and have similar conversations? And how do you feel you're now positioned within the world?
Honestly, it's having better boundaries. I used to think you have to give as much as you can give to everybody. And people are going to accept that, but they will never stop accepting it. So you will deplete yourself, you know, if you're doing it that way. So I've learned to be far more cognizant of my own limits and the way that I navigate. So I don't have to find the disbeliever and really impress upon them why they should try a different route. I don't have to particularly do that. What I do is do what I do and try to put as much energy into it where I'm doing it really well. And I'm doing it as genuine and as holistically as I can, and giving people moments and opportunities where I'm letting them know when I am available to connect and the type of things that are available for them, and showing them that I care and showing them that there's value. One thing I've learned from losing, I've lost a few friends by way of suicide, Pascal Walker, Kahari Charles. I walk with them every day. And I've learned that you give people their flowers while they're here. And you give that energy when you're present. And when you're not around, you can't do that. You can't be everything for everybody. You're not like Superman, like zipping in and out, giving positive vibes. You just really try to focus on doing something really well and try to give them the energy that you would want in return. So I guess in summation, I've learned not to deplete myself with that effort and be more intentional with how I show up around it.
Yeah. Even as you were summarizing there, I was thinking being more intentional. That's the takeaway, because like you say, we can feel we have to give all of ourselves, and it can be so difficult to set boundaries with people, you know, that we care about, particularly when, you know, you are working in an area where you see so much injustice. You know, the natural inclination when you're coming from that passion to change things is, okay, I need to just go all out until the world is fixed. And realizing that as brilliant as you can be, that is not a solo mission. And, you know, actually being more, intentional, more specific can make such a bigger difference. And I particularly loved what you said about giving people their flowers while they're around. You know, there can be such celebrating of people once they pass. And I mean, we see very much a kind of crowdsourced version of it now on social media, which I still find quite strange when people pass and then suddenly it's like everyone was a fan of that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just hope they were downloading their music when they were still alive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and the final thing I want to ask you about is you've mentioned fear a few times through our conversation in relation to what's happening broadly in society, in terms of social issues, in terms of losing your dad, in terms of losing close friends, and, you know, experiences, other traumas you've been through. Where do you feel now in terms of having lived through certain things, but then also getting to a place where you're part of such change and seeing, you know, the good in people and the way that communities can come together, as well as, you know, the disparities that can exist? How do you feel about safety now?
It's still something that we have to work toward and aspire to. I think a lot differently around my own feelings of safety, like my personal comfort. Do I feel safe now? Because that can have a very different relationship to the objective world. There can be a lot of things going on around me, or there can be nothing. But if I still don't have an internal sense of safety, I'm going to be interpreting everything as a threat. And when you're in these spaces of continued trauma, you can be activated all the time. You can be hypervigilant all the time. So I have to be really intentional around seeking my own sense of safety and being able to name that. There's some level or degree to which I do that relative to the work with B-Men and the advocacy and talking about men as victims. Part of the men as victims, black men as victims specifically, is acknowledging that there are situations that are not safe to us. We're not inherently buffered because we're male and we're men. But for me, I've had to really acknowledge that some of the work that I've done to change the world comes from an internal disposition of feeling unsafe, and find that you can still do this world-changing effort while having a different motivating energy behind it. That's where I'm at now. You know, I'm 34, I'm gonna be 35 soon. I'm a dad, starting to do dad things. There's a level of wanting to be settled with myself and the world around me that I'm seeking. I'm not the young soldier gallivanting into battle anymore. So there's, you change your relationship to different emotions. Now I'm expanding them. Before I restricted them, I felt like that's what it was needed to get things done. And to some degree, it was true, but can't do that forever. So that's where I'm at now.
Thank you. I relate to that a lot, actually. And yeah, thank you so much for being really open in this conversation. If people want to find out more about your work and potentially support it, if they're local enough, where should they go?
Yeah, check out bmenfoundation.org. That's our website. We're at bmen on all social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. You want to check out the work that I'm doing, martinhspeaks.com, or at Till We Free. I'm going to start writing soon, so you'll start seeing different publications, because, you know, all this stuff has to get out. But I appreciate any effort towards the things that I care about and engaging in it with me is great, and we'll get to where we're trying to go if we do it together.
Brilliant. Absolutely. Well, thank you again. It's been so great chatting to you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.